privilege to read in Cork, especially. I love Cork. And I apologise in advance to the people who have heard a couple of these poems before very recently at the Cork Poetry Festival. Jerry and John. Well, I know you were listening. So the first poem that I'm going to read is my Cork poem, the one that came second in the Gregory O'Donoghue. And when I came to Cork 30 years ago to go to college, there was lots of cinemas around the city. There was one on this street, and there was one across the road as well, and there was this boy. And then they all merged into one cinema, the Multiplex, on the Grand Parade. And then one day, the Capitol Cinema was taken down, and I remember, you know, it stopped at the traffic lights, and suddenly the cinema wasn't there anymore. There was a big hole in the cityscape, and I really wanted to write a poem about it, and I didn't know how I was going to do it. So I went and I stood there for a while, and I took pictures, and thought about it for quite a long time. And as Billy Collins would say, there was a lot of staring. And anyway, this poem came out. Portrait of the City with Mastectomy. The city is a woman, and I almost can't look. Someone has torn asunder her red and white dress, which was the gigantic for sale sign, taken a scalpel to her skin, which was the facade of the Capitol Cinema on Grand Parade, cleaved the flesh on the wall of her chest, which are red bricks and grey mortar, clamped a rib spreader on either shoulder, which are Tom Murphy's dressoir and a late night pharmacy, in order to hold back organs and tissue, which are dumper trucks, piles of rubble, and a team of men in hard hats and high visibility vests. Nobody should be able to see right through the lungs of the city like that, as if through the gaping backside of a surgical gown, as far as Patrick Street, whose buildings are a row of vertebrae that boats once navigated and where pedestrians now bustle, as if nothing remarkable has happened. Human eyes weren't meant to probe the dark alveoli of abandoned rooms in the Oyster Tavern from here, inspect the artery of Market Lane, or witness the scaffolding and steel girders holding up the old meat market like surgical instruments. Black plastic bandages flap in the wind, amplifying the persistent coughing of pneumatic drills. And all of a sudden, there's Auntie Anne on a red velour seat, hovering in a ghostly confetti of ticket stubs. 2 shillings and 6 pence she paid to sit up there in the balcony. Now, the yellow scoop of a digger is my mother's hand, manoeuvring a final silk cut purple to her lips, while the city holds the blue arm of a crane across her breasts to hide her scars. That was about my great Auntie Anne who died in my house, and I was mad about her. And on that same vein, I was very close to my great uncle Jimmy as well, and I went to his funeral in England last year, and sorry about the funereal theme, but he get brighter towards the end, I promise. So this poem is called Funeral. Sorry, just before I start this, just to say that he had dementia for a few years before he died, and he was married for, I don't know, 60 years, and so he'd kind of forgotten a lot of things before he died. So this is about his relationship with his wife, which is quite remarkable. So, funeral. What I remember of the day is white. White as the keening of the windscreen wipers under the blizzard at Seam. White as the taste of a snowflake falling through salty air. White as teardrops of wave-soothed sea glass. White as a plume of his bones made ash, fluent on the cold air as a gannet, which is the same colour as a white flag. White as the noise the telly makes at night when she falls asleep again in his chair. White as the dream she still has of the Limerick lace she sewed into the dress she wore on her wedding day. White as the gaps in his mind her name had long since fallen through. This one is called Lichenology, which I believe is the study of lichen. I still love lichen, I just love it. And I wanted to write a poem about it, but how do you write a poem about lichen? Anyway, I found this quote from the 1800s by this guy called Reverend James Crosby, and it says, "Lichen is an unnatural union between a captive algal damsel and a tyrant fungal master." Okay, yeah, that's something I can work with. So this is called Lichen. It's been in the Irish Times, so it's a proper poem. Okay, Lichenology. Suppose a fox is sly, an owl wise, a storm malevolent. Then suppose lichen is a sensational relationship between an algal damsel and a tyrant fungal master. Precisely how lichen is formed is a mystery, but suppose the fungus lured the algae to him, brimful of promise for a life of bountiful moisture. The fungus equivalent of rich, handsome, and a little bit audacious. Suppose he's holding her captive somehow, exploiting her vulnerability so he can use her unique tools for photosynthesis. Suppose he made her read all 3 volumes of 50 Shades of Grey in a weekend and she liked it, in spite of herself. And suppose she watches other algal damsels going to work on the bus or the train in Dublin, London, New York or Paris and asks what it is they are reading behind the winter issue of Poetry Review or the Wall Street Journal, biting their lips and insisting that the prose is atrocious and that there's nothing in their lives that is missing. Or suppose their symbiosis is something other than conflict. They seem at ease with each other. Suppose they're onto something. Suppose he didn't enslave her and make her take his name, and that she cooperates willingly. Suppose theirs is a clever survival strategy, an equally beneficial partnership with clearly defined roles. Suppose she likes that he is bigger physically so she can feel safe in his embrace, the way he weaves his filaments tightly about her and sees to it that she gets the right amount of light and water. Suppose she goes about the making of food gladly because when she's wet, she's turned on and then they go and grow as one. Suppose Lichen is happy. Suppose happiness is a flourish of Paris pistachio. Jungle green on the low branches of a willow by the river after rain. The way there is nothing more melancholy than bubblegum and hot magenta cherry blossoms on an April wind. So in my other life when I'm not reading poems at lovely places like this, I'm a teacher. And I taught for a long time in a prefab that was falling about my ears, and now I'm in a new classroom, and that's great, but I was a long time in the prefabs. And so anyway, I wrote, and so somebody once said to me one time, you'd be a great teacher if it wasn't for the curriculum. I'm going to give you a little bit of an insight into me as a teacher. I love kids, but anyway. So this poem is called Andromeda as a Teacher in a Prefabricated Classroom. Custodian of a cluster of stars, you only know the names of 9 of them. Johnny has aligned himself to your head. He is the brightest, one of the few new high-velocity stars in this constellation of teenagers that is running out of star-forming gas. Molly, at your left hip, is almost as bright, her stable spectrum an anchor point by which other stars are measured. Some position themselves at your extremities, so dim they're almost invisible, as if they didn't want you to know they are there at all. Alex stares into space by your right foot, You have tried to navigate as far as the faint galactic halo in his eyes, but it wears headphones and it is already thousands of light years away. Jack knows why stars twinkle and planets do not, but he cannot spell astronaut or satellite the way no star can paint or play a musical instrument. You do not ask him to read aloud in front of those more luminous. Nobody would hear him anyway. There are no sounds in a vacuum. No reason why anything would come to rest anywhere in particular. Everything in the universe has something to offer, you tell Emily, as you ink no grade in red across her copybook. But all heavenly bodies cannot be of equal brilliance, the way every colour cannot be yellow. Yet when you try to calculate her actual brightness, you get lost in a cloud of interstellar dust that is the curriculum. It absorbs an unknown amount of light so that nothing chimerical is visible here from Earth to the naked eye, except for you, Andromeda, the figure of a woman chained to the spiral galaxy of a prefabricated classroom by her feet and hands. As if in a dream where she is falling, celestial objects move in circles, you tell yourself, and earthly objects, only earthly objects, fall downwards. So I'm going to take you off to a little tidal island off the coast of Clifton now, to Omi, if anybody's ever been there. It's a really great place. But anyway, its last permanent resident died there in 2017, I think. And when there's a funeral on Omi, the cars come from the mainland, and at low tide you can drive across the sand to the island, and the cortege is going across the sand. It's quite something quite amazing over to the graveyard on the island. And this made a great impression on me. I didn't know this man who died, Pascal Whelan, but he just captured my imagination for some reason, and I wrote a couple of poems about it. And this one is called Cortege to Omi Island as Umbilical Cord. It's a little sonnet. You have been a receptacle for the dead for as long as anyone could remember. But when a vein of cars issues from the churchyard on the mainland, across the strand at low tide, I consider you more womb than tomb, your graveyard a belly button, tethered to the funeral cortege, your coastline fetal, its crown rump length of pink quartz equal to this mile-long cord of nutrient-rich bodies coming back to be buried, where they were born, in a place so heavy with descendants, its tidal waters keep breaking, pushing bones back up from the sand, swaddled in blankets of low growing time. So on that note, I have a prose poem about that. I just thought, God, if the only permanent resident has died, what a lonely place it might be. So I wrote this. It's actually published as a piece of flash fiction, but I really think it's a prose poem that drawn to anybody. It's called How to Measure the Loneliness of a Tidal Island. First, remove your shoes and socks, then step from east to west across the island's only road, counting as you go. Salute the farmer in the small red Massey Ferguson. If he waves back, which he will, you can subtract a quarter of a mile of loneliness. If he stops to chat on his way to feed his cattle, ask him if he's a permanent resident on the island. If nobody lives there permanently anymore, multiply the number in your head by 10, then add that to the number of cuts you got on the soles of your feet. That's the diameter of the island's loneliness, specifically the east-west kind. Next, you must do the rounds, that is, walk in the footsteps of pilgrims around the perimeter of the island's holy places, the church, the well, the cemetery, saying the rosary. However many sorrowful decades you get said, that's the circumference of the island's loneliness. At the ancient cemetery, fill your pockets with any bones that have come up out of the sand. Think about how many visiting children have slipped bones like these into their pockets over the years, mistaking them for the bones of animals and therefore treasure. Cup your hands around a bundle of finger and toe bones. Hold your hands up to your ear and shake them. That rattle, mingled with the sound of children playing, is the exact frequency of the island's loneliness. Make a large pile of some bigger bones. Femurs and tibias are good, or if you're lucky, skulls. Now dig a hole and bury yourself under them. Feel how heavy they are. Imagine how many bones have ever been buried here. That's the weight of all the loneliness the island has inherited. Not to mention all the tiny lonelinesses of the shells of cockle and periwinkle, razor clam and limpet, to the power of the time it has taken to grind them into fine sand. That's the purest kind of loneliness, the kind that breaks down in the interest of making more. Lastly, lie down with the island when it gets dark and monitor how many times a night the island turns over in its sleep and mumbles the word uninhabited. This is the threshold of the island's loneliness. When you're done, walk across the strand at low tide to Sweeney's Pub in Clatidoff, where you can put on your shoes and socks. There may be loneliness there too, but you won't notice because you'll be drinking a pint of Get Murphy's. And eating a toasted ham and cheese sandwich. Somebody may even be playing a guitar and singing a familiar folk song. Don't bother trying to measure anything on your way there, like whether the strand between Omi and the mainland is more or less lonely when the tide is in or out. Nobody has ever been able to measure that. In my other life as well, I have a son who's 17 now, but when he was small he loved to collect sea glass, actually he still enjoys it, I won't tell you about that. He found a piece of sea glass once and it had a little bubble in it, and so we looked at it for a long time and we marvelled at it, and this is called Sonnet for the Glass Blower. Look, ma, mermaid tears, he says, hands overflowing with sea foam, cobalt and honey, amber glass fragments, sharp edges, wave mended, but new skins etched with tiny seas, like echoes of a shipwreck's quiet sobbing. This one from Pirate's Cave is my favourite. He lifts it to the sun to show me why. The bubble inside reminds me of searching a fetal scan for a heartbeat. A bottle of milk of magnesia once. It's been holding the glass blower's breath in its belly since blown into life. I thumb its smooth curve the way you would a bottom lip. The dimple of air, blue and still in its small glass womb. So you heard us from Tume, and I'm afraid it's impossible to ignore the stories that are coming out of Tume now. And so I put it off for a long time, but I have written some poems in reaction to the modern baby home. My father was always going on about the home babies, but I never really took any notice of them until all of this came out, and then I kind of sat down again and said, tell me again about the home babies. And so I just preface these couple of poems by a little epigraph. And it was the Bon Secours Religious Order released a statement via a PR consultant, if you don't mind, in response to the juvenile human remains found there. And they said, if you come here, you'll find no mass grave, no evidence that children were ever so buried, and a local police force casting their eyes to heaven and saying, yeah, a few bones were found, but this was an area where famine victims were buried. So, yeah. So, this poem is called The Seventh Acre. A memorial garden squats on a small parcel of land behind a row of houses, like a Sheila Nigig, hunkered and holding her genitals open like two halves of an apple. A ruminant garden, her belly's distended by numerous stomachs. If you come here, you'll find her chewing her cud, coughing up a mandible, perhaps, or an ankle, spitting out tiny pips of spinal column. Somebody saw a small boy once running across her shore in scallop, rattling a skull on a stick. For this is the seventh acre. The acre that ate babies. But only the ones whose mothers were sinners. The ones it was right to leave nightly, rocking themselves to sleep. And the skull on a stick was one of the stories that came out that people were playing around the site before they closed it off, and this is from Halloween, look, and running around the skull. Anyway, so this is called Skull on a Stick. A young boy runs across the grass, rattling a skull on a stick. The skull has a near perfect set of teeth, and it bursts out laughing when it catches sight of them in the wing mirror of a parked Ford Cortina. And the more the skull in the mirror laughs, the more the skull on the stick laughs back, unaware it's laughing at itself. Are you my mother? The skull says to its reflection. The boy races through the bishop's spacious and well-kept palace grounds. Daddy, the skull blurts after a spurt of purple, ushered hurriedly into its large and handsome mansion. And then the boy's mother puts her head out an upstairs window yelling, put that thing back where you found it this minute, Martin, and get back here for your dinner. The skull doesn't understand, but it smiles widely with its near perfect set of teeth. There's a painting by Bruegel called Massacre of the Innocents, and it was overpainted, I can't remember the century right now, by Rudolf II, and there was babies who were massacred, and it was a horrible painting, so Rudolf II had it overpainted, so he painted nice things like cheese and, you know, ham and things, instead of the babies, so that it didn't look so grotesque. And when they went to restore it, they actually decided not to take off the overpainting, that it actually was more sinister as it was, and it added layers to the story. So I kind of thought it just spoke volumes about what happened in Tuam, and that it was overpainted. So here's a sonnet called Overpainting. In the same way that Rudolf II had the babies in Bruegel's Massacre of the Innocents overpainted, so Galway County Council sent men to Tuam with spades and grass seeds to lay down a lawn over the septic tank where juvenile human remains were known to be buried. In the same way, later, did the nuns issue a statement denying knowledge of it. In the painting, a woman weeps over an array of cheese and charcuterie, creating a scene arguably more resonant of calculated evil, the absence of blood and gore more eerie and still than the heinous original. This is my book. And this one is called Virginia Creeper. I was there on the site with a friend of mine last year, and I said, what's that plant there? It's a Virginia creeper, as if I should have known. So anyway, and this one has been shortlisted for Strokes Town, so I'm very excited, so I'm going to be reading there in a couple of weeks. So it's called Virginia Creeper, Talking to a Remnant of the Boundary Wall. Shade makes me aggressive. I twist my hair. I stare at my fingers. Don't say oppressor. I'm afraid of the dark. When I grip the throats of those weaker, it's not that I want to choke them. I need to reach your pretty necklace of broken glass. I only cut myself so you love me. Stop saying I'm clingy. It's not my fault all my thoughts are flawed. My bootless shoots rooted where they fell, and I fasten myself to you for a good reason. You could be ripped from me while I'm sleeping. Please, be my mother. I know my little green flowers are worthy and these blue-black berries toxic, but in autumn, I'll make you proud. Watch me set my every leaf ablaze. This one is in the Weller Review. Everybody should rush out and buy a copy of it. Mm-hmm. It's called The Art of Keening. Once there were women who were paid to cry when someone died, as if grief couldn't be left to amateurs. When the keeners appeared, a whetted hush settled over mourners. Keening was a glorious release, a vocal poultice that anointed every lesion, every cleavage. To keen was to penetrate grief, the way the sad arias of cows whose calves have been taken away to be weaned rupture the night like udders blurting out milk. Oh, how I bellowed involuntarily as you were being born. Yet when you died, I'd quite forgot how transcendent pain can sound when it throbs inside a song's hollow vaults. And one more on that sad theme, and it's called Voice, and this one won the AMBIT Poetry Prize, so I'm very happy with it. To go into the home was to be given your voice and spoon and told, swallow it. When they shaved our heads, our voices wilted and our tongues like dead nettles and empty cups. When they took our names away, the tiny venomous hairs of shame bore untold holes in our throats. When they insisted on silence on the birthing table just to remind us we had sinned, the itchy hives of guilt distended, red and angry in our bellies. And when she said, the child of your sin is dead, my heart was an extinguished fireplace. I opened my mouth to cry out, but spoke only in thin grey wisps of smoke. I'm going to try to have a little bit of a more hopeful note now. And we go back out to Omi, and we might start out hopeful now. And we know the killings that they had, those places for burying the children who were not baptized. And in Omi, there is this thing where their bones come back up out of the sand. They're buried so close to the sea and everything. So, but I think I'm turning it around a little bit. It's called Skull in the Sand. And after that, we'll go into some love poetry. Yeah. One morning, the tide drops a skull at my feet. A handful of small shells roly-poly from its nose holes. Strands of seaweed fan about its empty head. And the sea foams from its open mouth like a muffled conversation about drowning. Instead of reburying it, I place it in the crook of some rocks so the cliffs might cradle it. And the sea sing it ancient songs of wild salmon searching for the scent of their home river. At first, the wind wallops through the eye sockets with all its hollow, impossible thoughts. But soon, the skull is heady with the smell of wild mint and heather, not to mention the small talk of a wren. Before long, it jammers with twigs and moss and feathers. And the only thing on its mind by spring are five perfect white eggs with red speckles. Okay. I'm getting the notification from the back there that my time is nearly up, so I'm gonna.
It's okay.
You're fine. Yeah.
I'll read two more. I was lucky enough to get a second chance in love, and so this is a. This is a poem, the first poem that I wrote when that happened. And it's called Dragon Pearls. And it's an epigraph by Rebecca Perry that says, your smell was never unfamiliar. It's the third Wednesday in February, and I'm waiting upstairs in a cafe at 6 o'clock with a cup of jasmine tea. It's our first meeting, and I wonder, could a plant romantic. Jasmine might. Snow white blossoms, spoon tight at sunrise, that gasp of petals as they part in the dark, which signals a readiness for scenting, the layering of green tea buds and leaves the tea master has kept since April to be mated night after night for the perfect blend, then hand rolled into tiny silken pillows he calls dragon pearls. You offer your hand. It is exactly the right temperature. And one more. This is called anadromous vocabulary. And anadromous is the word for those fish like trout or salmon that can adapt to salt water. And I was thinking of words that become overused and lose their meaning. So it's in three parts. One, the words are wilted, clammy in my hand as a bad handshake. I toss them in the curb, watch them drop to the riverbed like mayfly eggs. A fingerling flips to face the current, stills in its rippling grip, waiting for what the river might bring her, and swallows it all, the insect nymphs, the mollusks, the vowels, and the consonants. Three little syllables ease through her gills, they silver, become anadromous, develop a tolerance for saltiness. Take us with you, they whisper, and she does. Two. Salmon know when it is time to come back to attend the regatta of the dun's newly exposed wings. They also know how to climb ladders. Onlookers gather to watch them take to the air, ejaculatory as prayers, because a single drop of home in a million gallons of seawater is erotic to them as the breath of a lover. For this particular fish, it is the limestone, the lichen of St. Michael's Well. It is the sperm of freshwater pearl mussels below the falls. It is shed feathers of the local heron and the landing dance of the cormorant where the persistent tongue of the river laps at the lake. She makes for the sweet spot where the pink-tipped stamen of the hawthorn fondles the water, inhales its almond pollen. Three. May Day dawns and she's barely glimmer in a quiet pool near the riverbank, weary of the fisherman. My dropped words have softened and polished in her gullet, the way waves mend sharp edges of sea glass. Soon she will open her mouth for the fly you have tied. Listen for the soft splosh of I love you as she leaps in the dark. Thank you so much.